This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. Well, don't forget, we get another Fed decision on Wednesday, and with investors nervous about the Fed's eventual tapering ahead of that policy meeting, we're going to tell you about the taper that will really bite into U.S. growth. This is a must-read today, I think, Ed. Let's get to Bloomberg News economics reporter Rich Miller. He writes about this. Rich joins us on the phone from Washington. Hey, Rich, good to have you here with Ed and myself. So we are all focusing on what we're going to get from the Fed on Wednesday. We're wondering if they're going to be more specific about when they will pull back on some of their asset purchases, their so-called tapering, whether or not we'll see that. You say there's something else we have to be watching when it comes to tapering. What is that?
Basically, the disappearance of all this support we've been getting from Washington in the form of, you know, stimulus checks, grants to small business, money for state and local governments, the whole panoply of things. That's all basically going away. It started going away in the second quarter, and that arguably is going to have a bigger bite, take a bigger bite out of growth over the next year, especially towards the end of next year, than the taper by the Fed. Because, you know, remember, the taper by the Fed is they're going to be cutting back on the amount of stimulus they're injecting into the economy. But they're still going to be injecting stimulus. What you're going to see on the fiscal policy side is that they're actually going to be the stimulus is going to disappear.
Rich, what's difficult to kind of make sense of is these measures were supposed to be temporary anyway, right? You know, in terms of payment support for employers, in terms of benefit and subsidy for those hardest hit by the pandemic. Why did economists and indeed the U.S. government not see this coming sooner?
Well, I guess, I mean, the government has seen it coming sooner, but the sheer magnitude of it is in a normal recession, you might have, you know, some of this and then it disappear. But this is a sheer magnitude. This is going to be the biggest swing in the deficit, i.e. the biggest fall in the budget deficit from one year to next since basically 1946 after the war. So On its own, you know, it's going to be a huge contraction. Now, I think the point you're making is, you know, there's going to be offsetting factors, right? People have built up savings during the pandemic because they couldn't go, you know, on expensive vacations, et cetera. State and local governments got a lot of money from the federal government, and they haven't spent all of it. Companies need to build their inventories. But even with all that, you know, some economists see, you know, this really having this fiscal, what they call fiscal drag, really having an impact on growth. And one economist I quote in the story, Wendy Edelberg at Brookings, say we might even see a quarter or two towards the end of next year or into 2023 where we don't grow at all.
Wow. I mean, that would certainly shock the markets. What's interesting too, Rich, in a story like this is always perspective. So all of this fiscal stimulus or stimulus that came from the government, I mean, it was a lot more than what we got from the Fed, correct?
I think even the Fed, you know, when you hear Fed Chair Jerome Powell, you know, talk, he gives great credit to Congress for acting quickly, especially with the CARES Act, the first act. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but he you know, he acknowledges that, you know, yeah, the Fed lowered interest rates, but, you know, it didn't hand out money to people, right? And the Fed did, you know, buy bonds. But, you know, he acknowledges that the fiscal thrust, the fiscal emergency stimulus was what really, really helped during the pandemic.
Rich, you flick at this in the story, but it's going to be painful for some people and potentially politically tricky for Biden, right?
Yeah, I mean, if these economists are right, you know, this slowdown is going to be happening just as the we're heading into the November midterm elections, you know. And
unless he gets his big plan through, right? I mean, that's the other factor in all of this.
I mean, that is a factor, but what, you know, what's kind of lost in the talk about the big plan, and there's a lot of big numbers thrown about, mm-hmm. but that's spread out over 10 years. So
and it skips 2022.
Exactly. So, it is going to help, over a longer period of time, but it's not really going to help next year. And some folks on Wall Street are saying, yeah, well, we might get the tax increases before we see the benefits of the infrastructure spending. And that would hurt the stock market, too.
It does sound like, just quick, Rich, just got about 30 seconds here, we'll also get a truer picture of the economy, right, as we start to back off of all these stimulus efforts.
Yeah, definitely. Once we come off the emergency support, we're going to have to see how much underlying strength is there and hope it's there and we can sort of stand on our own two feet, so to speak.
Right, which you wonder if, certainly ahead of the FOMC meeting, is, the real economy is what Jay Powell and company are looking to see. Rich Miller, it's a must read. Thank you so much. Rich Miller, economics reporter at Bloomberg News, on the phone from D.C. on his story, The Taper That Will Really Bite into U.S. Growth Isn't the Fed's. I mean, Ed, this is a really timely story and something we need to be thinking about as those policymakers get ready to meet and maybe update policy.
Yeah, and for the real economy, for the people that have lived on the subsidy, lived on the benefit, lived on the PPE checks, mm-hmm. You wake up one day and it's gone and you wonder how that really impacts spending going forward.
All right, something we're going to continue to track. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
One other story that we want to get to, and as we mentioned, it will be in the upcoming Sooner Than You Think Bloomberg Business Week issue. Joel is with us, and also joining us from Switzerland is Bloomberg Business Week writer James Tarmey. And we're talking about, Joel, tall buildings. Actually, they're super tall buildings.
The super tall ones. And here in New York City, there's been a couple that have gone up. And what James' story is really interesting about is, really, when these buildings started to go this big, nobody had done that really before, right?
Yeah.
And so they were kind of having to learn almost on the fly, and that has led to some lessons. And we'll talk about those lessons. And then the other big takeaway that I thought was just amazing is that we're going to start seeing buildings go even higher, which is really crazy to me because I just get my stomach kind of does a little, dance.
Don't look down. Don't look down.
So, James, what have been some of the problems that have happened with these super tall buildings?
Well, I think one of the biggest problems is that people don't know really what they don't know. And so every time that they push the limit, they find out something new, which is fascinating if you look at it from an engineering standpoint. Less exciting if you have spent a tremendous amount of money to live in one of these buildings and then discover that, well, actually you're living in a 2.0 building and 3.0 or 4.0 buildings are going to be the ones that fix it. We can go all the way back to something like the Sears Tower, which was incredibly high and which was just a feat of engineering and which was built with really not much wind tunnel modeling. And so they only discovered when it was constructed that there were basically wind vortices that were rattling the building and causing things to break. And it only kind of got worse from there as people discovered the full extent of what wind does to a building at extremely high height.
So I recently went on vacation to Chicago. And I took the official Chicago architecture tour. And, of course, one of the features is the Willis Tower. And it can sway 3 feet, on any day with the wind coming off Lake Michigan. And anyway, now that I'm done bragging about my vacation, James, my story, my question, rather, is, how important is it to have the bragging rights of the tallest super tower in a city? How linked is the skyline to the status of a city like New York, like Chicago?
Well, I think it's actually two different questions, really. One is from the developer standpoint, right? If they are able to say that the buyer of the building's apartment has views that are unlike any other, they can command, at least in theory, a premium. And then there's another component of it where you hit on it exactly, that it is not simply about economics when it comes to buildings that are not simply residential. There is a tremendous component of bragging rights to it. And it's been that way since the Empire State Building became this symbol for American prosperity. Now, you see it as kind of American dominance of a lot of different things sort of wanes. In the 90s, you see Asia becoming the place where super tall towers are built. And a few people with whom I spoke actually made the excellent point. Who ever heard in America of the Petronas Company until the Petronas Towers were built? And you can go from there. It's not necessarily a price efficient way of building when you're building all the way to the tallest building in the world, but you can, in a certain respect, consider it a marketing expense.
Okay, so let's geek out a little bit about the engineering that it takes to go super tall, because they've been able to do the ones that have been super tall, we now know what it takes to go even taller. Let's start with concrete, which you can now get 3,000 feet into the air.
Yeah, so there are a couple of issues with concrete which people have consistently been solving as they go higher and higher. The big one is that it needs to be a lot stronger for it to go that much higher. And the good news is that when it gets stronger, it also gets stiffer, which keeps a building from swaying. So the advances are pretty staggering. You were looking at, in the 1980s, PSI is a measurement of pressure that the concrete can withstand. You're looking at 6,000 PSI for like the top of the line buildings. Now you're looking at 3-4 times that amount easily. And so that is one component of concrete that is critical to these super tall, super skinny towers. That's the other thing. You can build as tall as you want if you're building it, you know, incredibly wide. If you're trying to build a super skinny tower, that's where the strength of the concrete comes in. Then the other component of it is that you have to be able to pump it, and it has to stay liquid, because people have discovered that it sort of firms up as you're pumping it, right? Because
it's like, hey, Joe, we got a problem. The concrete's hard. We've only made it to the, 500th floor. It's a great read, and as Joel mentioned, it's a fun story to nerd out on about the technology and what they have to do to make this happen. Check it out in the upcoming issue of Business Week magazine. James Tarmey of Business Week, along with the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber. You're listening to Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Top of investors' minds, you know it, we've talked about it. How far will President Xi Jinping go with his crackdown on China's real estate sector and more broadly in the economy? Well, to dissect it, back with us is Bloomberg New Economy editorial director Andy Brown, who continues to explore and write about the growing Beijing crackdowns, writing this weekend about how it now includes the casino industry in Macau. Andy, by the way, former China editor at the Wall Street Journal, and he's here in our Interactive Broker studio. So, Andy, you do write this weekend about what's going on in Macau. Once again, President Xi, kind of, it feels like going after some of the evils of the Chinese society, or so it feels.
Exactly, Carol. I mean, Xi Jinping, President Xi Jinping, sees himself as a historical figure on a par with Mao. And he is now in the process of trying to re-engineer Chinese society, to fundamentally change the way that China's society works, to make it less unequal. This is his slogan, common prosperity. And beyond that, to correct a lot of what he would see as being unhealthy tendencies in Chinese society. In other words, social vices. And gambling very much fits into that category.
There was this fantastic line in your story that gambling revenues from Macau are 6 times what they are from the Las Vegas Strip, which gives you a sense, right, of how, A, crucial that section of the economy is, but B, how far he's going. I mean, is this just a question of profits take a backseat to ideology when it comes to President Xi's mindset?
That's definitely part of it. You know, the communists have never liked gambling, all right? They banned it. They banned the horse racing as soon as they took over. They saw this as a remnant of the old society. Mm-hmm. And they inherited gambling in Macau from the Portuguese when they took over Macau, which is a Portuguese colony,
right,
in 1999. And they've sort of tolerated it, although their tolerance is wearing very thin. And in fact, when Xi Jinping took over in late 2012, one of the first things he did was launch this anti-corruption campaign. And casinos in Macau were early targets.
Well, I do wonder, Andy, if the inequalities that they weren't existing in the Chinese society, would we be going through this right now with President Xi?
Well, he's a populist figure, and he considers himself to be a Mao-like figure, and social equity is a very important part of his campaign.
But if there weren't the inequities in Chinese society, would we be going through this with President Xi right now?
Well, it's not just the inequities. I mean, he's addressing in a very decisive way a lot of problems that exist all over the world in mm-hmm. different societies. As an example, he's going after the video gaming industry because he's perceived that Chinese kids spend too much time addicted to online video games.
So different from what we're seeing in some of the developed world, even if you think about big tech, right? What we're seeing in Europe, what we're seeing in the United States.
Right, exactly. Except he's going after it in a far more peremptory, draconian way, with very little public consultation and certainly no media debate. This is top-down reengineering, definitely not democracy from the bottom up.
Join the dots for us here. What is the link between what's going on with China's gambling crackdown and Evergrande and the property market?
So here's the link, I think, which is this, that in re-engineering Chinese society, he's got to also re-engineer the economy. And the reason for that is that the big drivers of economic growth in China, most particularly the housing market, tend towards unequal outcomes. So if you were lucky enough to have bought property in one of the big Chinese cities 20 years ago, or actually any time over the last 20 years, you would have doubled, trebled, quadrupled, quintupled your money. I know this for a fact. I bought a place in Beijing in 2004 and sold it 2 years ago and did very, very well. However, if you are now a young family in one of those large Chinese cities, you're probably not able to afford a place to live.
Right.
And if you are, you don't want to have kids because you can't afford it. And that's another big motivating factor for Xi Jinping. There's a demographic issue here as well.
Well, it's so interesting in China, right, how it went from, one-child policy to now encouraging, right, families to have more kids.
Right, but who wants to have three kids
if
you can't afford it? You can't afford the education.
Feels like we're talking about San Francisco or New York or pick your city here in the United States to some extent.
Or indeed any big city now anywhere in the world.
Well, that's another part of it. And we'll talk a bit more about China, but there's another story on the Bloomberg that just talks about how housing now is really a global problem where there are so many around the world who cannot afford to live in many cities in their country. And then you're seeing, as a result, either hopefully policies change or upheavals or uprisings.
Indeed. Governments are falling as a result. We saw the Swedish government collapse earlier this year, and one of the reasons was that it tried to get rid of a cap on rents. The Canadian election coming up later this year is being fought in part on the issue of housing. Justin Trudeau has promised that if he comes back into office, mm-hmm. he'll place a moratorium of 2 years on foreign purchases of Canadian property, foreign purchases being a big driver of property price increases in Canada.
Andy, in terms of the news flow from China, is this just going to kind of continue where we're going to see more oversight, as you said, as he's, remaking the economy? We're going to continue to see this spread even into other sectors, or are we getting to the end of it, do you think?
We're at the beginning of it.
Okay.
I said earlier that Xi Jinping, the president, is trying to re-engineer Chinese society, and to do so, he's going to have to re-engineer the economy. And
is everybody on board with this in China?
Put it this way, you're not going to find anybody who's standing up.
He's going to say no
against Xi Jinping's plan to promote common prosperity. No, everybody in government, regulatory authorities. Is on board, and the sin, of course, is to underinterpret his instructions, not to overinterpret them. Hence, you're seeing this really fierce, vicious regulatory action against multiple industries. They've worked their way through digital platforms to fintech to edtech and now gambling.
You paint this beautiful image in your newsletter of private company CEOs in the blackjack, baccarat halls, the VIP rooms, rubbing shoulders with officials. That's where business gets done. So, you know, what is the conversation between the private sector and Xi Jinping? Is it open or is it simply one-way traffic?
Well, the conversation is hardly a dialogue of equals. These are solutions that are being imposed on whole swaths of the privately run economy. And essentially, you're there to learn your fate. And thinking about the gambling industry, you know, what might happen to the casinos in Macau? Well, you know, if they're lucky, maybe they meet the same fate as the video gaming operators. Those guys are now being throttled by regulation, including only allowing kids to play online games for 3 hours a week. If they're unlucky, they end up like the home tutoring companies, which are closed down altogether. There is no public consultation process in China overall.
No public commentary, right?
Exactly.
Well, what's interesting, too, is, and I wonder, Andy, because as you say, if we look at a lot of the developed world, Europe is looking at the growth and dominance and control of big technology. We are too in the United States. And we're looking at the inequalities in our society. So we're looking at the same thing. Obviously, China does it differently. But I do wonder if ultimately, I mean, China is so important in terms of the global economy. Does it ultimately, longer term, create, again, an even more dynamic Chinese economy?
Well, that would certainly be Xi Jinping's goal here.
Right.
To get there, if indeed they can get there, there is going to be a huge amount of turbulence. Look at what's happening now in the real estate sector.
Right.
Where Chinese authorities seem ready now to countenance the collapse of their second largest real estate company, Evergrande, all in the name of trying to make housing more affordable for the masses,
right,
not a speculative asset for the rich. Well, if he's serious about that, he's going after a sector of the economy that counts for between 25% and a third of GDP.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. A sector in which Chinese people have invested 40% of their assets, 90% home ownership ratio in China, one of the highest ratios in the world. If you had money, if you make money in China, you don't put it in the stock market, which is pretty much a casino in itself. You put it in real estate. And I think what people are underestimating here is the potential impact on consumer behavior. If Evergrande, this real estate giant, goes down, and if people perceive that the government really is ready to let real estate prices sink, what that does to consumer behavior.
And right, the wealth impact, right?
The wealth impact. And don't forget that consumption in China is a very low percentage of GDP, low in China even compared to Chinese economic peers.
Do you want to squeeze the last one real quick?
Yeah, very quickly, Andy. In two words, if they're going to clamp down on such an engine for growth, where does the growth come from in China in the future?
Just got about 25 seconds, Andy.
Okay, so I think the answer is very simple. They have to calculate that there's going to be a much lower Chinese growth rate, and it's going to be a more realistic growth, because so much of the growth now, China is on steroids, and that growth has been fake growth, and a lot of it is pumped up real estate prices, and we're seeing the result of that now in the Evergrande debacle.
So a real new growth equation going forward for China. Thank you so much. Thank you for sticking around, really giving us a deep dive into what's going on in China, which is, as we know, so much impacting the market today. Andy Brown, thank you so much. He's our Bloomberg New Economy editorial director, as we mentioned. Check out his newsletter that comes out at Bloomberg.com/New Economy. You're listening to Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
Driving crazy.
It's the questions that drive us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Yes, indeed, everyone. We are driving to the close. Just got about 9 minutes left in today's trading session. Bouncing off our lows, as you just heard from Charlie Pellett, but nonetheless, still down almost 2% on the S&P and down. NASDAQ, still a decline of about 2.5%. Let's get to it with Michael Sheldon, Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer at Hightower RDM Financial Group, joining us once again on the phone from Westport, Connecticut, here with Ed Ludlow and myself. Michael, good to have you here. September,
hi,
historically
Carol.
High. We know it's not a great month for stocks. How do you see the trade today? Is it China? Is it worried about what the Fed might do next? Is it worries about, you know, earnings growth, economic slowdown? Is it worry about higher taxes, or is it kind of all of it?
Well, today was certainly a challenging day for the markets, but I think you also need to keep things in context. Heading into September, for example, the S&P 500 had advanced 7 months in a row, and we had also gone almost a year without a 5% pullback in the S&P 500, which historically is one of the longer periods in history. So then you also have a number of these concerns, which you just pointed to, which sort of indicates the market's been climbing a wall of worry. You have COVID, fears about inflation and taxes and tapering, and add that over the past day or two to events in China and also the debt ceiling. So there's any number of factors that really contributed and weighed on the markets, and sometimes it's hard to pinpoint the exact reason the markets start to decline, but I think we've started to see a pullback. September, October also, as you pointed out historically, is one of the weaker times of the month. So I wouldn't be surprised to see a little additional weakness. To us, it seems that, we're constructive in terms of our intermediate-term outlook, but obviously there are some issues. Supply-demand imbalances in the economy, for example, for things like semiconductors and autos and the demand for labor, there's a need for more than 10 million jobs right now to be filled by companies. That's going to take a while to get worked out, and so we're keeping an eye on things. So we could be a little choppy for a while, but ultimately we see growth picking up again somewhat as we get into the next several months.
Well, two words we haven't really talked about today, Carol, is Delta variant. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had so much discussion around China and inflation, the Fed. But you seem, Michael, pretty positive, I guess, on economic growth, but with Delta variant still being a big question mark.
Well, I think it's important to sort of think about things. If you look at past cycles, for example, economic cycles typically last a number of years as opposed to a number of months. So, you know, it is true that this year will likely represent peak year-over-year growth in terms of GDP and corporate profits, but it's probably not the peak in terms of the overall economy. And also, if you look back at past cycles in the second year of bull markets, for example, historically, returns have been positive, but they've been more muted, more moderate. And I think as a part of the rewards of investing in equities over time, we look back and since 1980, for example, there's been an intra-year drawdown in the market, the S&P 500, of about 14%, but equity markets have still finished positive about 75% of the time.
But you still think we should be standing by for a pullback or indeed a correction?
Yeah, I mean, we've been thinking about this and talking about this internally for quite a while. As you pointed out earlier, there are any number of concerns right now, from tapering to taxes to COVID, and all of this is starting to sort of weigh on investors. But ultimately, we think COVID is probably one of the biggest concerns, and it looks to us like COVID is probably peaking in terms of the year-over-year rate, the second derivative in the United States. And and if that's true, that will help to increase confidence, which has also started to come down recently, and that should provide a boost to the economy as we get into next year and lead to more optimistic outlooks.
What's been fascinating, too, Michael, to watch, and I've been watching this so closely today as we've gotten on air since about 2 p.m. Wall Street time, that as we continue to see stocks take another leg down, all of a sudden you see like kind of a kick off that low, and then maybe it goes a little bit lower, but then again, buyers come in. This is something we have seen continuously in 2021, is investors coming in to buy the bottom, especially as we've seen those major equity averages hit that 50-day moving average to the downside.
Well, that's exactly right. I think there have been 9 times over the past year when the S&P 500 has been flirting with the 50-day moving average, and each time it's tested that level, buyers have come in. So we'll see what happens. Obviously, we're bouncing off the bottom here, so we'll see how things close today.
And as of right now,
is that a key thing in terms of how we close today that tells you really what's going on in investors' heads?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if the markets close close to the 50-day moving average and off the bottom, then I think that also reinforces the psychology that investors may start to come in. But we still do have a number of sort of headwinds or cross currents that could lead to choppy trading over the near term.
Where's the opportunity?
Well, I think for the market, the important thing is that we don't think this is the end. This volatility we're starting to see is the end of the economic expansion. And over the past several months, we've seen a more rotational market where growth, 1 week we've had growth leading, 1 week we've had value. So I think going forward, if you think of it in the context that we're probably going to be in the mid-cycle for quite some time, we've probably gone from early cycle to mid-cycle. I think in terms of your portfolio, the way we think about it is you want to be sort of more broad-based between growth and value. I think value may certainly do better as people think about growth in 2022, but I think the days of growth dramatically outperforming are probably behind us. So I think you want to have some exposure to both growth and value, and you want to also have some small as well in your portfolio.
Yeah, really interesting to say that. And the mid-cycle, just got about 30 seconds left here, Michael. I mean, they could last for a while, right, the mid-cycle part of this market cycle?
Well, that's exactly true. Economic cycles, again, tend to last a number of years as opposed to just a number of months or quarters. So we're likely to see higher GDP growth and profit growth next year. I think the estimates for next year are about 9 to 10% EPS growth and 4% GDP growth. Obviously, that could change depending on what happens in Washington.
All right, got to run. Good analysis, as always. Michael Sheldon, he is Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer at Hightower RDM Financial Group, on the phone from Westport, Connecticut.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.